Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Chip Giller, founder and president of grist.org and this evening's moderator. Tonight we are here to explore the global economy. What's it for and who really needs it? With Inforum's program, What is the Economy For Anyway? In today's uncertain economic environment, people have begun to question the true purpose of our free market economy. Our panel tonight represents a diverse group of thinkers who will help us navigate the true function of capitalist economies and debate the merits of our way of thinking. Tonight we host Annie Leonard. She is the writer and host behind the web-based documentary, The Story of Stuff, which presents a critique of excessive consumption by following the life cycle of goods and services. Also, Colin Bevan, the author of No Impact Man, whose year-long attempt to create no net environmental impact shows how, as individuals, we can help end the global economic environmental crisis. And David Batker, the executive director of Earth Economics, an organization dedicated to protecting the environment through the use of ecological economics. And kind of to kick things off, as my first question, I wanted to address this to Colin. And it is, Colin, who is No Impact Man?
Me. So No Impact Man was my response to the climate emergency. Back in 2006, I'd been writing history. And I just realized I couldn't write history anymore because I felt like everything, I was just worried about everything that was happening in our planet. And I wanted to, at first I thought I would write a hectoring book all about how you people should change. And then one day I came into my house and both air conditioners were on, even though no one was home. Because, you know, that 20 minutes it takes to cool down your home is terrible, right? And I realized that my own lifestyle was contributing to the problem. And I thought maybe if I changed my life, that would create a story that people on both sides of the political aisle would be interested in. And point up some of our environmental issues at the same time.
Great. And Annie, tell us about the story of stuff. What is the story of stuff?
Well, the story of stuff is a look at the hidden environmental and health and social impacts of all this stuff in our lives. All of this stuff has a life before we get it and after we get it, yet we're so focused to just pay attention when we have it. So I was lucky enough to have a job that for a decade took me around the world. I went to the factories where our stuff is made and the dumps where our stuff is dumped, and I wanted to share what I saw, so I made this film, thestoryofstuff.org, and you can see it online. We launched it about a year and a half ago, and to my utter shock and amazement, it has become this huge hit with now 7.4 million people around the world have watched this and written in and said they really resonate with the message.
And Dave, what is ecological economics?
Well, and Earth economics, what we're looking at, if you think about prior to the Depression, all we really had was microeconomics, looking at firms and households. With the Depression, we got a new scale of economics, a national scale, and that was macroeconomics. Though we've had globalization, we have no globo-economics. And so Earth economics is looking at a global scale. And these are really the crux of the problems that we're running into. Global distribution of goods and services and benefits to people, climate change, peak oil, etc. And so we look at natural systems and how really the next century is about public goods and services and their scarcity.
Got it. So you guys, I have a little conceit here. I feel like with some of my questions, I'm going to sort of act as the voice of the American people, an advocate for the American way of life, the champion of consumerism, to sort of represent that perspective here a little bit. And I have a question for Colin and David, and that is, isn't it true that if everybody in America or even a quarter of our population suddenly decided to live like No Impact Man, that the world economy would basically implode? Maybe Colin could go first.
I don't think the question here is whether people should live like No Impact Man. I think the question here is whether people should live in such a way that makes them happy. So the question is, how do we develop a quality of life where people are, where our economy actually facilitates people getting happy? And I think what we're seeing, what I see, part of the reason why I started the No Impact Man experiment is that, you know, people had supposedly achieved the American dream, yet they were depressed and anxious. And that's in the developed world. In the developing world, there were 1 billion people who didn't have drinking water. So the question is, is the economy, are we for the economy, or is the economy for the people? And how do we change the system in such a way that it facilitates a high quality of life?
I mean, Dave, maybe you could jump in here. I do just want to hit on this a little bit. Like, if we all left this room and just decided to stop shopping or stop consuming for a year, what would be the effects?
Well, first of all, people won't stop consuming. Mm-hmm. We will continue to consume. But the question is so pertinent. What is the economy for anyway? Mm. An economy is to produce desirable goods and services. So do we need 10 times as many plastic toys and acres of asphalt as we have now? Is that success in our economy? Well, no. Actually, what Americans are saying is they want more leisure time. If they want more leisure time, then probably means consume fewer other things. And so I think what we need, this question is as pertinent as it was in the 1930s. We really have a transition, and it's time to think about what we want out of the economy. And we don't have to worry about the economy collapsing because we have fewer plastic toys or asphalt, because we're going to produce other goods and services, and one of them may be leisure time that people want.
Well, Annie, what's so bad about cheap stuff? I mean, does a young college kid furnishing her first apartment or a low-income family with three young kids really need a couch that's going to last 50 years?
Well, what's so bad about cheap stuff is that it's the price tag that looks cheap. It's not really the cost of the item. It's because the true cost of making all these items isn't included in the price tag. So the reason these things look cheap is because workers in China or someplace overseas are being exploited, underpaid. Their unions are being busted. They're denied health care. The natural resources are being ripped out of the environment. The host communities there that live in the facilities aren't being compensated for the loss of their drinking water, for their health. All along the way, the supply chain, that's the term for the every step along the way of a product, the supply chain is causing havoc, environmental health and social havoc, and the companies aren't paying for that. So all of us are paying. So it's kind of like consumption on credit. We're not paying right now for the price, but we're running up a real bill on the price. I don't like to blame the individual that's shopping at Walmart or making the choice. You know, and this is one of the reasons why we have to have systemic change. We are not going to make the kind of change that we need by going individual by individual and saying, you shouldn't buy that cheap item because some worker in China is being exploited. We don't have time to convince everyone to stop doing that. Plus, you can't blame people for making choices in their own economic self-interest. That's why we've got to change the rules of the economy so that products are made in a way that respects sustainability and justice.
Do you agree with that, Colin? Do you agree, Colin, that this isn't really an individual? Individuals can't make a difference in this way, or it's not going to be enough?
I believe that it's not going to be enough if we just do collective action or if we just do individual action. That actually America's top climate scientist, James Hansen, is telling us essentially that if we don't stop burning coal in the next 8 years, that we will have irrevocably changed the planet's ability to support us. So that means that it's all shoulders against the door. It means that we need to, of course, we need lobbyists in Washington working with the legislators to try and get change at that level, but it also means that we might consider for ourselves whether the paradigm, the lifestyles that we have are indeed actually making us happy. Is it, you know, so many people are up to their necks in credit card debt. I mean, certainly, you know, we were spending way too much money and always worrying about the possibility of financial ruin so that we could chase after the next bit of stuff. So the question becomes, is it possible that we as individuals can find ways of life that are both better for us and better for the environment at the same time to complement the collective action that's happening?
Got it. You know, I wanted to pick up on something Annie said and address a question to you, Dave, and that is, I mean, she mentioned Walmart. And, I mean, I think I could make a case to this group here that Walmart perhaps is doing is the biggest source right now, perhaps, of greening the economy. I mean, they're asking their entire supply chain up and down their supply chain, their suppliers to put a life cycle cost on the goods that are being sold. They are just basically forcing greener practices through and through. And so isn't this an example of sort of capitalism that's working well in the best sense? And how do you view this? Because we hear people sort of rail on Walmart a lot, but I think perhaps they're doing some good here.
Well, I think one of the cores is that the rules do have to change. One company doesn't change the world's markets, and prices are going to determine people's behavior almost much more in markets than anything else. But just as in the U.S., we had working hours that were unregulated previously. That's basically what's happening in China, and all those products are still sourced from China. If we don't look at the rules that govern the economy and how goods and services are produced, then we can't get to solve the real problems. And I think Walmart epitomizes both the problems of externalizing costs and services, because there are still, even though they're looking at life cycle costs, there's still tremendous damage being done in China just from the production of their goods and services. And yes, a company can take steps forward. That's where we're going to have to go. But one thing I wanted to mention is that all economies are in transformation. And if you look at what Walmart does, the 20th century was about producing private goods and services because they were scarce at the beginning of the century. People actually didn't have enough to eat, and they didn't have enough things. The 21st century, we kind of solved that problem in the 20th century. In fact, many people would say we have too much stuff. Now we're short of flood protection. We're short of climate stability. We're short of water. We're short of storm protection. We're short of a different type of good and service, natural goods and services. And so our economy is going to have to shift in that direction. And are these same institutions going to provide these public goods and services? And that's why I think we're really looking at a very systemic change in our economy if we're going to be better off in the future.
If I could just add to that, Chip. There's a writer, Dan Barber, who wrote a book called Consume that I like very much, and he talks about manufactured need. And so at the beginning, when capitalism first began, it was kind of great, because what happens was that altruism was rewarded. Other people needed what you had, and you supplied it to them, and you got rewarded for it by getting paid. But the system has now changed where we actually manufacture need. We tell people, you know, the companies tell people that they should have things that they don't actually have, manufacture the need, and go out and get it. So when we talk about a transformation of the economy, the kind of thing that I'm looking forward to is where we move away from servicing manufactured need and move toward servicing real needs, like Dave was talking about, like flood protection or like drinking water to the billion people in this world that still don't have it. So it's not about deprivation. What we're talking about is not having less. It's potentially about having more of what we really, really need as human beings.
Andy, maybe we could tease this out a little bit. I mean, what is now being measured when we talk about economic growth, and what are some of the things that ought to be measured in your worldview?
I think that's such a good question, because we pay attention to what we measure. And what we're measuring right now is GDP, or economic activity. And I was just asking Dave Batker a couple of weeks ago what he thinks about GDP, and he said, it's a big, dumb number. And so what we were discussing is that GDP is like, if you're running a business and you make a list of all the money that your business spends, and you make a list of all the money that your company brings in, and you put them together into one number, that's your GDP. That doesn't tell you anything about how the business is going. And so what's happening in our country here, the way that we measure GDP, is that if you get cancer, the GDP goes up. If you crash your car, the GDP goes up. If you crash the Exxon Valdez, the GDP really goes up. So an ever-increasing GDP is increasingly divergent from an ever-increasing positive life. Or there's some other metrics like the genuine progress indicator. We're not measuring the things that really matter. So we have a growing GDP, and when it slows down, we panic and freak out, and there's all these newspaper articles about it. But we're not looking at it at the same time. We have a declining environmental well-being, sustainability, poverty is up, income inequality is up, health is down, obesity is up, all the things that actually matter we're not measuring and giving the same attention to as we are to just pure economic activity. For a while, economic activity was a means towards positive ends, but it's separated, and we're still focusing on the means rather than the ends, which is a better and more just world.
Yeah, Dave, could you jump in there and talk about maybe what we ought to be measuring? I mean, how would we measure a just world and a better world?
Thank you. Yeah, just a tiny historical digression, and that is, in the 1930s, there was no GDP. There was no measure of unemployment. There was no measure of inflation. We didn't even have macroeconomics. Well, how did we get those things? Well, as a nation, we decided we needed some new goals, some new economic goals, and we needed new measures. Unemployment was high. We needed to measure unemployment. And from that, we got new policies and new institutions, Social Security, the Agriculture Department, you know, a huge number of New Deal developments. And that built not a 19th century economy, a 20th century economy. So here we are today, and it's our duty to sit down and decide what we want out of the economy. What is the economy for? And a new set of measures, I believe, One of the most critical measures for America is how much time we spend where. This is what we're saying we're scarce of, in fact, is time with our family, time with people. We don't measure how Americans spend their time, although we know that they're spending more time working than for a generation. So time is critically important. Second, we need to know about what's happening to the scale of resources that we've never measured before, the climate, our water resources, even within a watershed. So, and that means, again, if we have new goals, new measures, new policies, new institutions. For instance, we've been working in the Northwest on a watershed utility. Watersheds are different than a car factory. They don't just produce a car. They produce clean water, flood protection, biodiversity, recreation, a huge group of bundled goods and services. And that means that when you chop it all up and you have a flood district and a water district and all these other districts, well, you have the stormwater districts getting water out of the city as fast as possible, and then the flood district saying, oh my gosh, we're getting more water than we've ever received before, and we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on both systems. So we need to start looking, again, at new goals, new measures, new policies, and institutions that really deliver the economy we want.
I mean, Colin, it seems like in some sense your experiment was almost, you were kind of like a forerunner or a harbinger of what the new economy might look like. How did people react when you were walking around Manhattan trying to do this experiment? How did people respond to you? And what happened in your sort of daily life to the quality of your life?
Well, so, for example, the glass jar is kind of one of my trademark little, I call it ostentatious unconsumption, because it's remarkable. Everybody says something about it. What are you doing with that jar? Starts a conversation. And I go into the coffee place with it all the time, and the baristas are constantly giving me coffee for free, which proves my thesis, which is what's good for the environment is good for the people, right? So people kind of respond because people have certain values, and I think we get confused between our hearts and our heads, and sometimes our heads are like, but we can't solve these problems, but our hearts are like, we need to solve these problems. Sometimes when we talk about economies and what's the economy for, it sounds so heady to me. And the real, to bring it to a human level, a lot of my experiment, my year, asked this basic question: what are people for? Right? Why are we here? I mean, it sounds like I'm going really esoteric here, but I'm not. Because if the answer is to have really big houses and to park jet skis in our garage for all but two weeks a year, then we're fine. If that actually turns out to be the answer, then we're fine. But this economy that we're talking about needs to be in service of what people are for. And most of the people that I meet, that the values that were kind of brought out by the No Impact Experiment had to do with human connectivity. When you get rid of this stuff, what replaces it is relationships. Dave talks about time. I think time is what we need. Leisure time is what we need. But what is it that people are looking for with that leisure time? It's to spend time with people that they love.
Annie, some reviewers have referred to your video as sort of an anti-capitalist critique. Are you anti-capitalist?
It's so funny, because when I made this film, I was not setting out to critique capitalism. I was setting out to really show people where all their stuff comes from and where it goes. That was literally my only goal. And then all of a sudden, Fox News is calling me Marx with a ponytail and saying Annie Leonard, and actually Fox News said Annie Leonard, if that's her real name, and said it's anti-capitalist. So what I actually did was got out my old books on capitalism and dusted them off, and I said, oh my God, I am anti-capitalist. I remember at one point my mother called me up and she said, they're calling you anti-capitalist. And I said, Mom, I realized I am anti-capitalist because the way that we're running capitalism right now is fundamentally incompatible with ecological sustainability. We have this total hyper-growth, more, more, more capitalism, and we're on a finite planet. You asked earlier about what we're measuring. The Global Footprint Network measures something really interesting, which is how many resources we use each year compared to how many the planet produces. Right now, globally, we're using 1.4 planets' worth of resources each year. And I was at a presentation recently where people started debating, it's 1.1, it's 1.6. I said, look, buddies, anything over one is a problem. We have one planet. We're using 1.4 resources. This year, Global Overshoot Day is September 25th. That means from September 25th on, we are consuming into the natural capital, the natural stock of the planet, and eating into the planet's ability to produce next year. We've used up the entire year's worth of resources by September 25th. And I'd make a strong case that a hyper-growth, profit-maniac capitalist system is driving that consumption. And we've only got one planet, so we simply have got to figure out a different way to run it.
Do you subscribe to that too, Dave?
Well, I think that...
Do we have to leave capitalism behind?
I think we'll always have markets. We'll always have trading. So I don't think it's quite a choice of just capitalism or non-capitalism. But what produces the goods and services that make us better off? What is the greatest good? Gifford Pinchot said in 1908, the economy should be to produce the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run. And that makes a lot of sense to me. But it also means that, as Annie said, I think a market economy falls short in many places. Take a look at Katrina and what happened there. We lost 1.2 million acres of wetlands between 1930 and when Katrina occurred, that hurricane. 1,400 people lost their lives. For every 2.5 miles of wetlands, you take off 1 foot off a storm surge. So even though Katrina packed a 29-foot storm surge, it hit New Orleans with 16 feet, still demolished the city, but the wetlands reduced it. That counts as zero because it's not traded or there are no goods or services traded, et cetera. It's just nature's free goods and services, which we've depreciated that capital, sadly. And so if we don't start waking up to the foundational importance of natural systems. In fact, the economy resides within natural systems. That's not what we're taught in graduate school in economics or anywhere else. It is a foundation for the health of our economy. And if we don't encapsulate that, we're going to be in big trouble. And I think currently the way we practice economics and our production and consumption of goods, we don't count that.
So Colin, I mean, I feel like some of this conversation is a little heady. I mean, how do we get from here to there? Because what I'm hearing from the panelists is like we're looking for real systemic change. How do you think we should get from here to there?
I mean, I think, first of all, by believing that we can all make a difference. I think there's a... Sometimes if we're not careful, we get in a conversation like this and we become overwhelmed. Like everybody's talking, you know, this, you know, different type externalities and all these terms are like, what are we supposed to do as people about externalities? And I often, people come to me all the time and ask, well, what can I do? And I basically, what would you like to do? You know, like what do you think your skills and talents are? Because don't wait. We have to take collective action. One of the organizations I work with in climate is onesky.org. They help you, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, politically, they help you to get in touch with your congresspeople. That's action that you can take. The idea that we should, you know, wait till 3 years from now to the next presidential election to make our voices heard is not so correct. And I would argue that actually we can turn as individuals to the problems, and that it's our responsibility, but more importantly, that it actually improves your life, because it's not fun to feel like a victim. And one way to get, I think many of us do feel like victims at the moment. We feel like there are problems that we can do nothing about. And so the trick is just start. Choose your issue. Get involved. It doesn't even matter if there's an organization that exists. Just start.
You know, Annie, I'd kind of like you to contribute to that question, too. And, I mean, something that that I sometimes experience, and I'm wondering if you experience this, too, is sometimes people are a little maybe tired of being nagged about all the things they're doing wrong. And how can we turn this around and make it a more positive thing?
Well, I do think the nagging is not a effective strategy, and I speak from personal experience of having done it for 15 years, and it did not work. So what I've learned instead is, and I really agree with Colin on this, is that the kind of changes that we need to get the planet back on track really are more fun because they involve re-engaging with civil society and with community. Colin said that when people ask, what should I do, he says, what would you like to do? And I used to do that, but it's one of the things that makes me worry now, because when I say, what can you think of to do, people always say, I'll shop differently. I'll buy this instead of this. or when I show the film The Story of Stuff in audiences, which is like a 20-minute really rant about how bad the planet is right now, people always raise their hand and say, what can I buy differently to solve this problem? And what I've come to see is that in each of us, we have two different parts of our identity. We have a consumer part of our identity and a citizen part of our identity. And that consumer part of our identity is stroked and validated and spoken to and reaffirmed from day one. Like, I have a little girl, believe me, it's from day one. We're getting Dora the Explorer shoved down our throats, you know, from day one, whereas the citizen muscle has atrophied. And so what concerns me when I go around the country giving these talks is how much we're stuck in that consumer part of our brain, because we're familiar there, it's comfortable, and we really need to rebuild that citizen part of our brain. We need to rebuild it because it's an engaged citizenship that's really going to turn the country around, and it actually is more fun. There have been all these studies about happiness and what really brings happiness, and nobody on their deathbed says it was their country home or their flat screen TV. It's the quality of their social relationships. It's having a sense of purpose beyond yourself. It's coming together with others around a shared goal. So the same thing that actually will make our life sweeter can help us retake back the government and move it in a direction towards sustainability.
Dave, are there examples on the ground where we're seeing kind of new economic models emerge that have been successful?
We are, and it's very exciting. In fact, you can take a look at San Francisco Public Utilities. There are six public utilities in the West here that filter their water through natural systems, the forests and natural areas. That means San Francisco avoids about a $300 million filtration plant. And they're starting to say, actually, in these six utilities, Seattle, Tacoma, Vancouver, and such, in the past, they've looked at their assets, and this is the way we look at all of our assets, as just our built capital, the pipes, the vehicles, and the buildings. And now we're saying, wait a minute, actually, it's the watershed that produces the water and filters it. That's our real capital asset. And what they've run into is the problem of how to do the accounting. And so now these six utilities have gotten together, and they've said, actually, we need a new accounting system. That way we can actually justify greater investment in the watershed and provide greater service, cleaner water at a greater abundance. There are many cases like this, and I agree that the root of them is citizenship. Because almost in every case, it was citizens who came forward and said, this is the way we should approach the issue. And in Louisiana, it's the same thing. Very interesting, looking at sort of a utility structure for restoration of the wetlands. If you pay for insurance, we all share the potential catastrophe cost, but we don't do anything to prevent it. But a utility that actually rebuilds wetlands and puts water and sediment back out actually provides hurricane protection benefits. And so just like you pay for a water utility, you can pay for a hurricane protection utility. So I think there are a number, and whether it's credit cooperatives or a variety of other things, there are a lot of cases on the ground, and it really is, as always in the U.S., it comes from local to the national, and this is the way we're going to get things to change.
May I add something? Yeah, Colin. So we've talked about two extremes now, consumer and citizen, and I think that it's very true that we need to pick up our role as citizens. But the idea that we only exist as consumer and citizen is somewhat problematic, because let's also not forget community member. Both consumer and citizen speak to us being part of a centralized system that's far away. And one of the things that I talk about that sometimes is unpopular in the environmental movement is just the rebuilding of local community. Which in some ways it doesn't have much to do with consuming and doesn't have much to do with voting. It has to do with actually spreading in your community a different sort of value.
Why is that unpopular?
It's unpopular, I think, because we've become so used to these roles as either consumer or citizen. And so people are only used to models of change that it fit in either of those two places. But the truth of the matter is that if we are going to get the kind of support, the citizen support that we need for regulatory change, then we actually have to change culturally. And to change culturally means changing our community values. And so I would argue that in some ways, if it's possible for us as people, not as consumers, not as citizens, but as people, to promote community values, which can be as simple as, like, you know, gathering people together to play, to eat together, to have people – The truth of the matter is that the more the studies show that the more we understand our social connectedness, the more we understand our environmental connectedness. And these changes at a personal level is how we get cultural change as well, the cultural change that will support legislative change.
Annie, have you witnessed a conversion moment where, you know, you've been out there with the story stuff and you think this has really turned someone around, or do you think your work has been preaching to the choir?
The response to this sort of stuff has just amazed me at the sort of 45 conversion moments you hear about a day. We are just flooded by emails. We have a backlog of about 50,000 emails of people who have written in and said things like, I knew that, I just didn't know how to say it. Or people who say, I never thought about any of this, and you know, you've ruined my Saturdays because I used to go to the mall and I don't want to go there anymore. One woman wrote in and said, I'm an SUV-driving Republican housewife from Texas, and I used to take my daughters to the mall on the weekends, and I don't want to. What should I do? I found that the story of stuff tapped into like a latent conversion moment in a lot of people. I feel like broadly in society, there's a growing sense of dis-ease, whether it's that you don't feel safe letting your kids run around in the street outside like you used to when you were little, or it's the growing information about the toxics on the food or toys that we bring into our house. On so many levels, there's a growing sense of dis-ease, and I feel like the story of stuff sort of provided a narrative for people to understand where some of those problems were. So I'm delighted to say we're hearing about conversion moments all the time.
Yeah, I mean, Colin, I kind of want to ask you the same question. You know, when you were walking up, I mean, because it seems to me that you were almost a newcomer to some of these issues just mm-hmm. a few years ago, mm-hmm. and you were approaching them sort of fresh eyes, fresh experience. But how did people respond to you as you were going about your experiment?
Well, while I was doing it, I had a blog, and I still do. It's No Impact Man at noimpactman.typepad.com. And literally thousands upon thousands of people came to the blog, and they started to, almost in spite of me, in the comments section of the blog, they started to discuss amongst themselves how they were making the kinds of changes in their own lives that I was talking about. And on the blog itself. And so there was it's exactly what Annie was talking about, this kind of dis-ease. You know, when people ask me sometimes about various environmental issues, sometimes I already say, like, you already understand. Like, you feel it. It's in your gut. I say that to a lot of people. I feel it in my gut that we need to be differently. And so people were responding on the blog and actually working together to change their lives. I think the reason why it became so popular is because people don't like to admit there is a problem if they can find no solution that they can take part in. If I can't do anything about it, I just deny that the problem exists. And so when we start to talk about the possibility that we can be both civically engaged and individually engaged to the solution to these problems, all of a sudden people are actually willing to discuss the problem because they know they can be part of the solution.
So, I mean, I was looking for, I mean, any color here, like, would you walk up with your mason jar and people are like, what the hell are you doing? Or, I mean,
not
it just
to
seems
my
like
face.
In Manhattan, it's just, okay.
sure. Well, actually, Manhattan is a bastion of liberalism. What surprised me was, of course, people, it's a threatening issue. What No Impact Man points out, what Story of Stuff points out, what Dave's works point out is that there's something wrong. There's something wrong. And people don't want to hear that, you know, because it's scary. I know it scares me. And so people will criticize all of us because they're harbingers of bad news in some ways, but also of mm-hmm. solutions. Mm-hmm. So you get that, but you also get the people. Well, what I was going to say was what I was surprised about is the tremendous response I got from across the aisle. I mean, I'm very out there about the fact that I'm a liberal. When I say that I'm a liberal, though, it doesn't mean that I don't want to talk to conservatives. It means I say it because I want to talk to conservatives, and conservatives came to talk to me at the blog.
Got it. You know, Dave, I'm kind of just worried about your personal journey, too. I think you were at Greenpeace for a number of years, probably dangling off buildings and holding up posters and things like that and railing against the man. And now, now, you know, it seems like you're working at a more you're analyzing societal trends and presenting a new framework to think about ideas. So how did you get from here to there, and how do you feel like, how has the effectiveness of your work shifted?
Well, I think we really shifted from announcing the problem to focusing on the solutions. And there you really do get some amazing wake-ups. And I think the issue is to take what we've always had as the polar opposites constantly fighting and show that actually we don't need to do that at all. And I'll give you one case. In the Green River Valley, which Seattle is one city of, there are 15 cities there, and they had a salmon restoration project to put these off-channel sloughs in so juvenile salmon could come in and where salt and fresh water mix. It was kind of a pipeline with levees. And initially, the Chamber of Commerce and the port and Boeing and a number of others said, oh, my gosh, what is this? We're going to spend $5 million on this? What is this, $1,000 per salmon? This is kind of a ridiculous project. And then we said, well, you know, this is a watershed, and when you put those off-channel sloughs in, it's not only for salmon, but it takes all those floodwaters, slows it down, gives it a place to go, actually saves the levees downstream. It provides flood protection benefits, too. And amazingly, the whole group, this was a steering committee of 70, if you can imagine, at that time. Mm-hmm. It had the Master Builders Association and Audubon, and people used to arguing with each other. And suddenly they all went, this is a great project. We all like this. And they voted unanimously for it. So I think our focus, one thing as Americans that we should celebrate is our pragmatism and the fact that we like solutions. And having more leisure time is a solution. And looking at the way our stuff is made and consumed and making a more conscious choice about our lives, that's a real solution. And I think the more we focus on practical solutions, the more we find that all those old enemies suddenly kind of dissolve a little bit, not always. There are plenty of things that we're not going to dissolve very easily. But I think that's kind of an aha. The other thing I just wanted to mention on that is that we need to think about a bigger scale. Think about my grandmother. The first time she voted was when women were first allowed to vote. That came about by a social movement. And the progressive movement between 1900 and 1910, we had 1,500 amendments proposed to state constitutions, and 900 passed. That was because we had citizens and communities that decided we needed to do things better and have better solutions. And I think for our own kind of progressive movement in our country, it's time we thought on that scale. We need to think on a bigger scale about how we redefine property. We more carefully define property rights. Water doesn't fit well in just these boundaries of a piece of property. And so ecosystem services and things, we need to look much more closely at these issues if we're going to have a higher quality of life.
Annie, do you think the Obama administration is a friend toward this cause, toward this shift?
I just heard yesterday, Obama, oh, bummer, which is really sad. It's hard to know what the reason is for the gap between the campaign promises and what he's delivering now. And I'd like to hope that it's just the system that is forcing him to compromise and give up so many things that he had promised us. It would break my heart and my faith in electoral politics to think that he actually believes the things he's advocating right now. But I'm deeply disappointed on the cap and trade, on the climate changing, on some of his appointments like Larry Summers, on his inability to stand up and protect Van Jones, who he recruited heavily to come to the White House. I'm sad on the Obama front, I'm sorry to say.
I mean, Dave, are there any embeds in the administration who are in line with your work?
I think quite a lot. Of all non-malleable places, the Bureau of Economic Statistics, more or less, they've said, you know, we need some new measures. Their crowning achievement, by the way, is the GDP. That was a government creation by an economist named Kuznets. But they've even said, you know, we're not measuring quite the right things. We need to measure some new things. And they've got good support in Congress, and I think some in the Obama administration. I think that we need to think, there's one view which was the same thing in the Depression. Do we rebuild the economy that we've had a crisis in? Do that again? Or do we build a brand new economy in a lot of ways that serves people better? And I think that's the transition we need to look for in the Obama administration. And economists like Joseph Stiglitz, I think, really highlight a new vision, a better vision.
Got it.
May I say that I'm not sure that what this points to, what's been happening with in terms of whether Obama advocates for climate change legislation at this moment or not, especially when he's trying to push through health care, whether that says much about him so much as it says something about central government and its ability to actually cause disruptive change. That is to say, I think that in order to achieve the kind of goals that we have to solve our crisis, I believe that we have a joint crisis. We have an environmental crisis, and we have a quality of life crisis. That is to say, the planet's not happy, the people aren't happy either. And I'm not sure, I believe that government plays a role. I repeatedly say this. But again, I think it requires us, and I don't necessarily know the answer, to look for further and other models of change, because big government can only, the pendulum swings of big government are narrow. And so how do we actually get, we can't count on central government to do everything for us. So we have to figure out other ways of change too.
Annie, do you think that by encouraging people to change their lifestyles for their own benefit, like Colin's work does, and the benefit for the environment, might we also be creating an on-ramp for the masses into politics?
Oh, absolutely. I'm all for living green, and I live in a great kind of co-housing community and have an electric car and compost and have worms and all that. I'm all for living green. But I think the danger comes if we mistake that for political activism. There's a lot of reasons to live green, to consume less, to consume more consciously. Bringing less toxics into your home protects yourself and the workers. Buying locally supports the local economy. There's a lot of positive benefits, but I think the number one positive benefit of implementing these lifestyle changes, as Colin also mentioned earlier, is bringing into greater congruence your values and your actions. And it's from that place of greater integrity or greater congruence then that you can engage as a community member and as a citizen for the deeper structural change. So absolutely, I'm in favor of the individual change, but it's not the same thing as political action for changing the rules of the game.
We're going to be taking questions from the audience in about 4 minutes, so if folks have questions, please line up at the mics. Colin, I can't let you go without asking you. I need to ask this question. Have you retained any of your year of no impact habits? What ones have you shed?
Oh, well.
How much of a freak still are you?
Here, we continue to do what makes sense for us. I let me tell you.
Dodging the question.
It's just not having finished the question yet. Let me tell you a story. Isabella, we changed to reusable cloth diapers when we did the project off the plastic diapers. Now, there's this crazy debate about whether reusable cloth diapers or plastic diapers are better. And guess who? The studies say that it's the same. But guess who funds the studies? Let me tell you, it's not the cloth diaper people. So, but here's the thing, right? So after we changed diapers for about 2 weeks into it, I couldn't find a cloth diaper, and there was one plastic diaper left, and I went to put the plastic diaper on Isabella, and she started screaming, Bella, new diapers, daddy, new diapers. Sometimes I say if you were to wrap saran wrap around your nether regions, you would understand. But the point is here, like, that sounds like a trivial story, but it's not. The point is here that there's so much that makes sense for people as well. Like, of course, organic cotton against my baby's skin is right. So similarly, it's right for us to save $1,200 a year by not using air conditioners. It's right for us to get fit as part of our daily routine by continuing to bike everywhere. It's right for us to eat food that's actually good for us and doesn't have any ingredients in it whose names I can't pronounce by continuing to eat good local farm-produced food. And it's good for us to continue to be civically and communally engaged because it makes us feel like we're empowered and it makes us happier.
Got it. I think I'll go to questions now. So as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inform, and tonight we're hosting What is the Economy for Anyway? I'm Chip Giller, founder and president of Grist.org and moderator of this evening's discussion. And with me are Annie Leonard, the writer and documentarian behind The Story of Stuff, Colin Beavan, author of No Impact Man, and David Backner, executive director of Earth Economics. And you, sir, get to ask the first question.
Thank you. So Colin mentioned something that I've heard a lot in America, which you seem to be, from my perspective, if I was understanding you properly, casting aspersions on the ability of a central government to affect change. From my perspective, what I see is it's not an inherent problem with the central government. It's a problem with the amount of influence that vested interests have on the central government. If you had a central government that actually was by the people, for the people, etc., that wouldn't be a problem, I don't think. What's your response?
Yes. Last year, the fossil fuel industry spent $200 million in Washington. Right. So and people sometimes say, therefore, we can't change. We can't do anything at central government level. But the other side of the coin is here in the United States, we kind of bound between 50% and 60% of the people voting. So here becomes a thing that politicians do what the special interests want unless the people can prove to them that they want otherwise. In other words, if the people give the politicians a clear mandate to disobey special interests, then they'll do it, because the politicians want to be reelected, right? So what that requires is more of, just exactly more of what we're talking about, which is, I'm not into this debate of individual action versus collective action. I call it engaged citizenship, which is both. So it means we need to be involved in both. But it's important not to wait around for change at central government level. Let's get community change and individual change and state-based change as we also work for central government change.
Thank you.
Hello. The question I want to ask you has to do, well, I feel that a lot of this talk has been at a macroeconomic level looking at government, in particular the United States. I come from Venezuela, which is a country that has been one of the most aggressive in promoting radical, deep change, structural, and criticizing capitalism. And sadly, I think that what has happened in Venezuela has been the creation of a system that is not sustainable in an economic or social sense. What examples of countries have you found that you think are moving towards the direction that you would like to see the United States go towards?
Do you want to take that, Dave?
Sure. I think you're correct. And I think a good example is Costa Rica, which ranked almost the highest on happiness and kind of quality of life scale. And also, they've implemented some very creative policies. For example, in 1996, the country was 21% deforested. They were having more flooding. You could only turn on the tap for water 12 hours a day in San Jose and other cities. They were running out of water. And it was because cattle ranching was expanding, very marginal, actually, economically, but better than they cut down the timber and put in farms. So the government instituted what they call a kind of a payment for ecosystem services program, part of it was a national tax on gasoline and fossil fuels to cut down on carbon emissions, and then they reimbursed that back to landowners who replanted and kept native forests and such. It was a hugely successful program, one of the only countries in the world that has been reforested to a large extent. They're about 42% forested now, and the country is also, this is the most popular tax in the country. It's a tax, and 80% of the people support it. So I think that there are a lot of solutions like that. We were just with the National Academy of Science in China, and they're reimbursing 40,000 farmers for flood protection benefits they provide. So I think that we need to look at those successes, and they don't necessarily come from Europe or the United States or Japan. And they're spread quite widely, but I think there are a lot of good things happening.
I want to take some more questions from the audience, but can you guys just unpack for me a little bit how we measure happiness? I mean, I'm hearing this term happiness show up, but how the heck do you measure happiness? Maybe Annie could speak to that first.
There's a bunch of different ways to measure it, and there's some fascinating books. I really recommend The High Price of Materialism by Tim Kasser, where he's done a number of studies of having people answer hundreds and hundreds of questions about themselves, everything from I care about how people perceive me to I've considered suicide over the last year, and like in just incredibly in-depth psychological studies. And then they also even ask other people to comment on you. So there's a very well-developed study of this. what Dave just talked about was really interesting is the National Happy Planet Index. What they do there is they take quality of life times life expectancy to rate happiness, and then they also look at the country's global footprint or national footprint, how many resources they use. And that, I think, is the most interesting figure because they put those numbers together. So it's not just how happy countries are, but how happy they are per unit of resources they consume, or basically how effective a country is at converting natural resources to human well-being, which is life quality times life expectancy. And if I really recommend you go and Google the
national... Out of curiosity, where does the U.S. stand on that?
I believe it's 170 countries this year, and I think the U.S. is 150th. Mm. All of Asia is above us. All of Europe, all of Latin America. Costa Rica is number one this year, which, by the way, did decide to get rid of its military and redivert those resources to social and economic well-being. The only industrialized country below us is Luxembourg, and then it's pretty much sub-Saharan Africa. So I think that's a really important figure to point out when people say, what's the economy for anyway? The current one is just not really working very well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways we can do better, and they unpack it much more deeply in this National Happy Planet Index.
Next question.
Thanks. My question is about doing less bad versus doing good, which I hear a lot about. If you consider any sustainability discussion, it's pretty much, you know, using 20% less energy, using 20% less oil. People feel really good about buying a Prius because it uses, you know, 20% less fuel. At the end of the day, you're still burning coal and you're still, you know, pumping gas. So I was wondering where, this is kind of a two-part question about where you draw the line between good and less bad. And secondly, how you relate that to the citizen-government interaction. So I read, after the climate change bill came out, I read a good Greenpeace flyer, which you might be familiar with, about how basically it was discussing what are you willing to get arrested for. So, you know, what point do we get to that state where we're, you know, willing to put ourselves on the line and, you know, do passive opposition and that kind of thing? Versus writing our congressman. So, in other words, when do we get to the point where writing our congressman isn't enough at the governmental scale? And at the personal scale, how do we focus on, you know, doing good versus doing less bad? So,
Collins,
it's kind of a big question.
This one's in your wheelhouse, baby.
So each of us makes a certain environmental impact. Let's just for the sake of argument say it's 20, which means we can reduce our environmental impact by 20, and that's it. But I believe that our capacity for good is limitless. So, yes, it's important to consider the key here, I think, is this question of waste, right? To me, it's waste if we're using resources that aren't improving human quality of life, right? So the question, why is it that so many countries get more happiness out of their carbon buck than we do? The question is, what are they using the resources for? So if we're using the resources to reduce infant mortality, then the result is that we get higher life quality. If we're using the resources to get, you know, just for the sake of argument, more SUVs on the road, there's a possibility that we're not getting the life quality return. So what are we using our resources for? That's the why. It comes back to, why are we alive? Because our very lives are resources. As far as you know, writing your congressman versus civil disobedience versus, you know, different ways of demonstrating change. I honestly think that we're at this state where we have to. The question to me, the question becomes: how do we change the electorate? That's how do we change? How do we sway public opinion? So, do I believe in civil disobedience if it's necessary? I do believe in it. Am I sure that at this particular stage it will do the best to create change? I'm not sure yet.
Annie, do you want to jump in on that question at all?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. First of all, have we reached the point where we need to go beyond writing our congressman member? Yes, we have reached that point, definitely, and we should all do more than that. I like to look a little bit deeper when I'm looking at the different kinds of approaches we can take. I think that right now we have an economic and cultural paradigm that's causing a lot of trouble. It's a paradigm that says economic growth is more important than human health. It's more important than social equity. It's more important than ecological survival. That's the dominant paradigm we're operating under. So I would say an action is good if it challenges that paradigm and hopefully replaces it with another. And an action is not good if it's reinforcing that paradigm. Unfortunately, a lot of the what we call false solutions to try to address some of these problems are actually reinforcing the very power relations and paradigm that got us into this mess. And it's like, we tried that. It didn't work. We really need to try something different.
Let's take a question from over here.
Annie, I was wondering if you could address how you mentioned living in a sort of co-housing neighborhood. How have you impacted your neighbors with what your work and vice versa? Is there synergy there? And what's next after Story of Stuff?
Well, some of my neighbors are here. I love my neighbors so much. You know, I talk all the time about community is the solution, community is the way we're going to turn things around, and I know that from personal experience, because by living in community, we lessen our impact, we eat together more so we don't have to go to restaurants as often, we share stuff more, we learn together, we pitch in together. It's, you know, living in community for me is my number one favorite thing about life. It allows you to unplug from that work, watch, spend, consumer treadmill and reengage in community, and I really recommend it. And if you don't live in community, go invite your neighbors over for dinner. It is so valuable and sweet. And what's next? I just finished the Story of Stuff book, which will be published in March by Free Press of Simon & Schuster, and we're making a bunch more films. We're going to do the story of bottled water, the story of carbon trading, the story of electronics, and a whole bunch of different specific issues related to consumption and production. So keep visiting our website. There's one of my roommates right there about to ask a question.
Sure, why don't you go for it?
I can testify it's great living in community. My questions are for David. David, I noticed a couple of – it seems like transportation is a major paradigm shift that we have to make. A couple of things I've seen lately. I guess Phoenix has a new public – they have a new light rail, and folks are saying, hey, it's not paying for itself. It's not fair. We need to increase the fees. But wait, what about all the roads and the parking? So how do we – the same thing with Amtrak. I come originally from Boston. We have this $15 billion big dig, but we can't fund Amtrak to fund, you know, rail down the Northeast Corridor. How do we bring that into the picture? The other question is around how far do we go? Is it a slippery slope around putting a price tag on everything? I know a lot of indigenous communities are very much opposed to the payment for environmental services because they don't want to put a price tag on their cosmology and what really values. Is it a sort of slippery slope around, you know, will we at some point decide, you know, that Gunnison sage grouse is not worth saving, you know, but the spotted owl is, you know.
Let's start with the slippery slope question so we can get one more in because there was a couple there. So that's it.
Okay. On the slippery slope, I think it's really – in fact, we've worked with a group of indigenous people in Asia and also in Latin America and around water and issues like that. This is highly contentious to put prices to things. And I think what's critical is that we see the difference between price and value. You don't pay money for your family or your relationships or your community – but it's maybe the highest value. Price is a market allocation tool. And so one thing we talked about, for instance, in Latin America, we worked with groups on water, is that we do have to recognize the full value of the system which provisions water and ecosystem services and see who the beneficiaries are. And the things that destroy that, we call them the blight factors that might destroy that provisioning of benefits. And then how it's best managed. And it may not be best managed in a price system. But the difference, I think, between value and price is very important. And so commodification is really what people are concerned about there, whereas what we're saying, and I think what a lot of indigenous people are saying, is we need to look at value. So, for example, we worked in the Amazon on Yasuni, and a little more oil there for us, does that make any difference in our lives? Probably not, actually. It would make almost no difference to anybody's lives. But for the Huarani, it's life and death. And so for them to keep their natural systems intact is of tremendous value. It's life or death. Commodification has worked in a damaging way to the Huayrani because their values aren't counted. But I don't know if that helps. I did want to get to the other portion of that question just briefly because it comes to a core issue that Colin brought up also, allocation of resources. So whether it's transportation or anything else. And this is why work on the national scale is so important. If you look at economic transformation, we can do it in 10 years. Between 1934 and 1944, the U.S. economy was completely remade. In 1990, China's economy was one-tenth the size of Russia's. By 2000, it was 10 times the size of Russia. What made those differences? It's because we took tremendous amounts of capital and reallocated them differently. Right now, we've decided that, and this is why in the United States, we cannot leave decisions about where trillions of dollars go simply to say we're going to do the same old thing that we've done in the past. And that's why banking regulation and looking at investment and stopping speculation, all those things are absolutely crucial. Anyway, I won't go into it too much further, but the hub of changing our economy, where our billions of dollars are invested, or trillions, that's the economy we're going to end up with physically. And if we we have to pay attention to that.
Let's take one more question.
I just had a quick question about just your optimism or sense of optimism for ability to affect change. You're talking about regulations and new rules at a government on international level, because it seems that it's easy here or in New York to say, wouldn't it be great if the government did what we want? But we have all met a lot of people, and they're not all ignorant, between here and New York who would think very differently. And then internationally, it seems to me that most of the world, the vast majority of the world, is still at a stage where one more thing is actually leads to a lot more happiness, one more pair of shoes. So I'm trying to understand, how do you, at this time of urgency, how do you combine those two, and how can you be optimistic about your ability to do that?
Why doesn't Colin answer that question? And then the panelists will be outside to talk in depth about some of this stuff.
So the thing that we have to be careful about is thinking that there's two sides, the Democratic side and the Republican side. And in fact, there's a people side. That's it. And one of the reasons why I promote individual change and cultural change is because many Americans on both sides of the aisle appreciate values like community, like relationships, like that they want more leisure time. And the possibility of talking about those values rather than being straight in each other's faces about the politics at first. So the question becomes, can we culturally begin to agree on how we want to live as people? And so if we can talk in this way on both sides of the aisle and then move into the politics, then there's a chance that we can actually get grassroots pressure from below. If we can, in other words, if we can convince people to live environmentally is better for the people, then maybe we can get grassroots pressure on both sides of the aisle.
Annie, do you want to jump in there? Bring it home.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me, do I think we're going to be able to change things? And I am absolutely positive we're going to be able to change. Change is inevitable. You cannot continue to use 1.4 planets worth of resources on one planet indefinitely. Change is definitely going to happen. The question is it going to change by design or by default? And if it's by design, it's still going to be hard work. Life is still going to be different. There'll be some losses and some benefits. It'll be really, really hard to figure it out. But we can be a lot more compassionate, a lot more intelligent, and a lot more just. If we change by default, if we wait until our back's up against the wall, which it's getting awfully close to, it's going to be a lot uglier, a lot more violent, a lot less just. I like to liken it as the car is turning directions. You want to be at the steering wheel or you want to get run over. And I vote for being at the steering wheel. So I think we need to be proactive and change by design and not wait until our backs are up against the wall. But change is definitely coming.
All right. Well, here's to being the steering wheel. Let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight.
And
now this meeting of Inform in the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.